Is there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Welcome to Words to Write By. Renee, what words have you written this week?
What words have I written? I have written chapter notes for Patreon, and we're almost done because we're almost done with Gardner.
As of this podcast, we are done with Gardner. Has this been feeding your inner academic teacher need?
You know, it has. I'm taking a leave of absence this semester, so I haven't really been teaching, which is where I kind of get my academic fix. But Gardner is so academic that it doesn't really feel like I'm not at school teaching. It feels like I'm there. I guess it does get my fix, although it gives me a bit of a sinking feeling because the more I write these chapter notes and I analyze his language, the more I get this feeling I had in grad school and even as an undergrad. All the name dropping and the confusing prose that doesn't have to be confusing is very intimidating. It turns people off and it discourages students.
Are you feeling like a gatekeeper?
I don't want to be gatekeeper. I try not to be a gatekeeper. But it's been so long since someone's tried to gatekeep me. I know all the tricks he's pulling. It still makes me invoke my past self as a student. It's a lot of the source of my negative self-talk. So I don't really appreciate Gardner that way.
It's going to be good to move on.
It's going to be wonderful. So, Kim, what words have you been writing?
I've been plugging away at this short story. It's amazing how something that's probably going to be less than 6,000 words is taking so long to write. I use the word counter when I'm doing it. I'll work on something like, man, this is only 250 words. And I'll work and work. Man, it's only 400 words. Usually when I get past the 800, 900 mark, then the words come faster. But that first 300 are really hard to get. So I'm looking forward to the new book that we're doing because the opening chapters really do point to a way of writing that I would absolutely love to adapt my style to.
Ray Bradbury shares his secrets for how he wrote so many unforgettable short stories in the first two chapters of his craft book, Zen and the Art of Writing. In today's episode, we discuss his strategy to be engaged in both the ideas and the process of writing. We also unpack his technique to mine his subconscious for story ideas and explain why so many of Bradbury's titles were simple nouns. We invite you to join us as we dive into this phenomenal craft book.
What we're starting this week is Ray Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing. And Yay. If you check out our previous podcast, we have an interview and kind of why we chose this book. So I think we're just going to jump right in. Unlike Gardner that had multiple points in his chapters, so far this book is one idea per chapter. So we'll cover the preface and the first two chapters today.
The chapters are rather short. They all kind of speak to each other. But like Kim said, there is a thesis and that's it. He just focuses on it.
And he uses really beautiful language too.
You can tell he does have fun when he writes.
I liked in the preface at the very beginning, if you do not write every day, the poisons would accumulate and you would begin to die or act crazy or both. You must stay drunk on writing so reality cannot destroy you. What did you think of that? You must stay drunk on writing.
That really spoke to me, especially when you're in the groove. When you're working on a project and it's coming together, it does kind of feel like you're drunk. And when I don't write for a while, it does drive me a bit crazy. I sit on that couch and I'm watching Netflix and all I'm thinking about is I'm supposed to be writing. I should be writing. I should write about that. I should write about that. Why aren't I writing? And I'm just sitting there anyway. How does that speak to you?
My problem is when I stop writing every day, it is hard to start again. There's just a big impediment. And I thought with the drunk analogy that there's maybe a writing hangover you get to, which reminded me of when I was on a foreign exchange trip in Germany. And at a certain point, all the 17-year-olds got together from the American 17-year-olds. And one person was saying that they discovered this great thing. If they'd had something to drink the night before and they woke up and they drank something else, the more alcohol, it helped the hangover.
Oh, gosh.
I'm not sure if that's the best advice, but maybe I get writing hangovers and I just need to start writing again.
Yeah, yeah. I have on and off been successful in a daily writing practice. Right now, it's not happening. I want to do it so bad. Sometimes I've been able to do it. And then I feel almost like I write every day and I get egotistical about it. And then I fall off the wagon and I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have been so.
By this analogy, you fall onto the wagon.
I fell onto the wagon.
This writing every day advice is something you see all over the place. Yeah. And various techniques you can have to count for writing every day. Sometimes I see a workman approach to it. You know, you just got to stick your butt in the chair and you got to fill out the pages. And it's just something you do every day to develop a habit. But Bradbury's got a more enjoyable take. He makes it sound fun and glorious and a calling. And isn't this what you want to do?
Right. He even says, first and foremost, we are alive. And that is a gift and a privilege, not a right. We must earn life once it has been rewarded us. Life asks for rewards back because it has favored us with animation. So while art cannot save us, it can revitalize us. Writing teaches us what it means to be alive, part of breathing. He also uses a fun analogy in the end of a grenade going off.
With this kind of joyous writing, he starts with the first chapter being called The Joy of Writing. Mm-hmm. What's in this chapter, Renee?
So in a nutshell, it's all about passion. One, as a person, you should be passionate about something. Two, you need to know what it is you are passionate about. And usually that will equal you having fun in the process. He goes into a little bit more detail about writers, but really he talks about zest and gutso. He uses these terms zest and gutso. And I kept like reading them like, what is he talking about?
Are we cooking something here?
Yeah, he's like zest, gutso, the most important items in a writer's makeup. The things that shape his material and rush him along the road to where he wants to go. I could only warn him to look to his zest, to see his gusto. What does he mean by gusto? What does he mean by zest? How did you take that?
I took that as passion. I have writing projects like my current writing project where I'm like, okay, I need to sit down and write this section. And now I'm writing the section. And now I'm rewriting the section. And now I've gotten distracted. Now I'm getting back to rewriting this section. But in the past, I've written some things where it's like, I am into this. I am creating new things. And oh my goodness, I can't believe I came up with that idea. And there's just a emotional connection I have to the writing. And it was so much easier to write when I had that emotional connection. He says, write about what you love and you hate.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been since you wrote a story where your real love or your real hatred somehow got onto the paper?
I think that's key. I think you have to really love or hate what you're writing. Or not hate what you're writing, but you have to feel passionate about the idea behind your writing. I recently wrote a novella about a haunted house. Part of the reason why I wrote the story is because this was a house that I used to live in and a house that I loved. And I felt very close to it. When I was writing about this haunted house, my love of the house itself, the description of the crown moldings or the plaster walls or the wood floor, or any of those other things were things that as I was writing about it, I remember them and I tapped into my love of this old house.
Right, because it's a value to you. You value a home.
So even though parts of the story were about the scariness of the ghost or the frustrations the people had in it, it could be something very odd that you love about the story that isn't necessarily just the plot.
It's more like what gets you to sit down and write the story, what helps fuel you while you're writing. Again, he says, the things you love and the things that you hate make up who you are, your points of view, and essentially makes you care. It's the things that we care about that make us emotionally react through our art. And that's what keeps us going. If it's too much of an intellectual process, it just kind of comes out flat. If you write with passion and you have your characters share your passions, this has that added effect that they're more believable. Their motivations are more real.
It'd be interesting to take a successful writer and look at their various pieces and say, were you passionate about each of these ideas? or whether there's something that you just wrote because it was easy and it came out okay and someone published it. And if you could actually sense a difference in the quality of writing, if they were really engaged with it versus they were, you know, they liked the idea, but they were easily distracted by other stuff.
Bradbury actually talks about the greats, like some great artists. And he says the important things are those passed down to us from their hands and minds. And these are full to bursting with animal vigor and intellectual vitality. The hatreds and despairs were reported with a kind of love. He claims that these writers' hatreds and loves and despairs were in the pages of their work. And because they were so strong, that gave them a lasting life. There's a way to do this, dear listener, supposedly. He even says, here is my formula. What do you want more than anything else in the world? What do you love or what do you hate? Find a character like yourself who will want something or not want something with all his heart. Give him running orders, shoot him off, then follow as fast as you can go. The character, in his great love or hate, will rush you thought to the end of the story. The zest and gust of his need, and there is zest in hate as well as in love, will fire the landscape and raise the temperature of your typewriter 30 degrees. So essentially, write down a list of what you love and hate. Create a character like yourself and give them those qualities. Allow the character to fantasize and have a desire and make the character as passionate as you are. At least that was my take on it. What is your take on this?
I saw this as a way to connect with your writing and to cause you to be enthusiastic about it. Since you give the characters your own passion or their own frustrations, you're connected in a way like with friends. You know, it's amazing the kinds of road trips or activities we'll do with somebody because we love them and they really want to do it. I'm not sure if just simply writing a character that is as passionate about something that you're passionate about necessarily ends up with a good story.
Interesting. Well, you wrote that story Membership about that woman. I guess maybe I just projected you into the character, which isn't necessarily the right thing to do, but she had a lot of the same qualities and background.
So in that story, both she and I had moved from the Midwest to Santa Cruz. But whereas I grew to love Santa Cruz despite the various warts and things that I didn't like about it, she did not. So I gave her a passion to hate Santa Cruz, whereas I love Santa Cruz. There was a weird dichotomy in the writing. I allowed her to act out on all the things that were wrong with this town. It's inverted. I gave her a passion, but I gave her the other side of the passion as to build the story and to have something bad happen to her, as opposed to my experience in Santa Cruz, where a lot of good stuff has happened. Because a lot of good stuff happening wouldn't make for a good story.
That's true. Having the love of Santa Cruz, maybe it was easier for you to access what's the opposite. Mm-hmm. How would somebody on the opposite end feel about this town?
Right. I think that's the reason why, in the end, the story, even though it has some faults in it, I'm very pleased with how it turned out because I was able to channel those ideas, an inversion of those ideas.
So I guess that was chapter one.
So chapter two has a bit more of this is the steps that Bradbury took.
It has more of the subconscious source of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, first you have to have passion, but then you have to have topics.
Yeah.
And so this one focuses on how you get your topics.
He's definitely of the idea that writing should be fast.
Well, drafting should be fast.
The faster you blurt, the more swiftly you write, the more honest you are.
Like he says, we can learn from lizards because lizards are fast. I took that to mean that he was talking about drafting, like a first draft.
Right.
I don't think he was just writing and then that's it, off to the presses.
No, he obviously did all that editing. But when you get that idea for the first draft, you should just focus on writing because sometimes you get a great idea and it's like, I'm going to go to bed and wake up tomorrow morning to do it. And you wake up and there's nothing there.
Yeah. It's first impressions are the most accurate. But if you think about it too long, you forgot all about whatever that first impression was.
Mm-hmm.
How easy is this? I tell myself, or I've read this before, we should write fast. And then I can't do it. I overthink everything. Do you write your first draft fast?
I've done both methods. When I've written them fast, I've finished them. And when I've written them slowly, I put them aside. That's the issue I'm dealing with my writing right now. When I had this idea for the story, I didn't finish writing it. I came up with some ideas, I put it aside for several months, and now I'm trying to get back to it. And it's a valid story. I'm getting some very enthusiastic feedback from people, so I need to keep writing. But I just can't find that groove again.
So you gotta speed it up.
I think so. When I get done with this one and start on the next, I think I just need to lock myself away and tell the family to go do something else and just write for as long as I can. The problem is you're determined to do this and you lock yourself in the room and you spend the next 4 hours procrastinating.
Totally. And I've read various tactics. Shut down your internet, write by hand. It is still really hard. My brain will wander. I can live in my brain. I have lived in my brain for a long time, and it's very easy to just sit there and not do anything. I think it's easy to say write fast. I think it's too easy to say that. Maybe that's for some writers. Maybe it's for Bradbury. Certainly for Bradbury. He was very prolific. I don't know if I can do that. Maybe it's something I could try to force myself to do.
Before we go on to the trying to force, I'd like to point out one small thing that he says here. He talks about imitation. This is a topic that was covered in Gardner's book. And he writes, I tried to write stories heavily influenced by various of these writers and succeeded in making quadruple layered mud pies, all languid in style that would not float and sank without a trace. I was too young to identify my problem. I was so busy imitating. He's taking a very different stance than Gardner. Gardner said that through imitation, you would learn technique and develop as a writer. Bradbury is saying that he just needed to get away from all that to write his own stuff.
So I don't know who said it, but some writer said you spend a long time sounding like a lot of other people in order to find yourself. I think Bradbury's forgetting that all that imitation got him somewhere. It helped him find himself. I guess because I have the academic background and I've heard it so many times before, there's imitation and then there's inspiration. And at some point, imitation becomes inspiration. You go from one and then you may not even realize that you've been doing it, but after a while, you've come to find your own voice. What do you think?
I don't think he's saying that you just write in a vacuum. He lists tons of authors that he loves and that he respects, and he's obviously read them carefully and he has absorbed their style and their ideas. He says you need to read and grow as a writer through your readings. But people can say, I want to write like this person. And in their efforts to write or sound a particular way, they ignore what their natural voice would be.
I can see that. It does take a long time to develop one's voice. There was one thing I didn't actually understand in this chapter, and it was actually about the imitating. He goes, I loved them, as in the authors. I loved them, and they smothered me. I hadn't learned how to look away, and in the process, look not at myself, but at what went on behind my face. And I kept reading that, and it gave me some weird, unsettled feeling, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what he was saying. So what do you think he means by that?
Everybody has experiences, and those experiences often make for good stories. But what makes for great stories is not your own personal experience, but the humanity as a whole's experience. And so it's important to draw from the specifics of your own life, but the universality of everything. He talks about the skeleton. His experience of skeletons was that weird feeling of being in the doctor's office and seeing the human skeleton and knowing that was underneath his own skin. So his face, what he himself experienced, was being in the doctor's office and looking at that skeleton image. But what was behind his face was the knowledge that all of us have a skeleton in us. All of us have something horrible and scary inside of us. And that's moving from the specific Ray Bradbury, a kid in a doctor's office, to why not write a story about a man who is terrified to discover that under his skin, inside his flesh, hidden, is a symbol of all the gothic horrors in history, a skeleton. I fell into my typewriter with it and came up with a brand new, absolutely original tale, which had been lurking under my skin since I first drew a skull and crossbones at age 6. We're digging into the metaphor behind what he means to get behind his own face. He's looking at a skeleton himself. But it's your own personal experience raised to a level of universal.
So it's not just the individual of who you are looking in the mirror. It's the process of that. What's going on in your head? What's going on in universal experience? The working through it.
It's not, this is what I saw. It's, this is how I felt and how other people would feel, or how someone reading this story would learn how to feel in reaction.
Not surface level stuff, but deeper stuff. Nice. All right.
And that's a great way to move into a technique that he discusses. He says, I began to make lists of titles to put down long lines of nouns. These lists were the provocation, finally, that caused my better stuff to surface. I was feeling my way towards something honest, hidden under the trap door on the top of my skull. The lists ran something like this: the lake, the night, the crickets, the ravine, the attic, .. the mirror maze, the skeleton. And in the course of this chapter, he goes through various stories that he came up with from this list and why he put down the words in the first place and what they were digging into.
As the list goes on, you can kind of see how it's like a self-hypnosis. He's like digging around in his subconscious. He doesn't necessarily know where these words are coming from, but he writes them down, and then later on he can dig into them to get these stories, and he breaks down the stories. Do you think that this is a good method? Do you think this is something we should try?
I think it's something we should try. The question I have is exactly what are we trying? Some of these words are very generic. The lake, the night. How does he generate this list? One of them is called the crowd. And the crowd turns out to be this horrific experience he had when he saw a car crash and people die. He linked that up to the crowd of people that gathered around at that time. And that's where he drew the story from, was all these individuals coming out to see this accident. But if I were just reading this through and say the crowd, I could imagine, well, that's the day after Thanksgiving sales.
I think when you're writing the list, there's going to be private symbolism in it, and they're going to be personally charged. If somebody else is reading your list, that list might see pretty generic. But when you read your own list, you're going to know what all of those things are referencing.
But when he wrote the crowd, that was his subconscious talking. He wasn't thinking, oh, I remember that one night where I saw the car accident. What do I remember from that? Right?
I don't know.
He has this list that he's just drawing these words from, these nouns. And then I began to run through those lists, pick a noun, and then sit down to write a long prose poetry essay on it. So it looks like he's relying on his subconscious just to come up with the words. And then he looks at the words and he identifies, well, what does that word mean? And then he writes out an essay, prose poetry. What did you take this to mean?
So he says, if you are a writer or would hope to be one, lists dredged out of the lopsided of your brain might well help you discover you. Even as I flopped around and finally found me, I began to run through these lists, pick a noun, and then sit down to write a long prose poem essay on it.
And then it follows up with somewhere about the middle of the page, or perhaps on the second page, the prose poem would turn into a story.
Right. So say I'm going to do this activity, right? I would sit there and I would write a free association of nouns. Just whatever words come to mind. I wouldn't try to think too much about it. I actually do a lot of free writing, and I would do this by hand. And I would just come up with a list. And then I would go back through the list. Maybe I'd take a break, go drink some coffee, come back. And then I would pick one. He says prose poem. Now, I wrote prose poetry in graduate school, and a prose poem is a poem without line breaks, and it's the internal rhythm and the rhyme and the theme that pulls the reader through. And I think when he says prose poem is to allow yourself to just kind of free write with meaning. Like, what do you really think about this? Not to think so hard that you're looking at every word and painstakingly trying to figure out what it means, but to just figure out, where is this coming from? Where is this leading me? Open yourself up to discoveries and to have some fun, but also not to take it so seriously that it must be a story already. He also says essay. So prose, poem, essay. It's like one word. For me, it would just be a matter of digging. I would just keep digging and digging. So what's the point? What's the point? Where is this coming from? What are my feelings?
And the language you could just describe could jump around. You could be like, I'm looking at this word, the crowd, and it's reminding me of this one thing that happened. This is how it went down, but it could also be this other element here. More of a prose would be, I remember the crowd coming out and then I was feeling this poetry. You could be like, the crowd, the images, there was a ghost-like metaphor. I think the idea is that you just write it out and you jump between these various types of writing, but you just keep concentrating, like you said, on that word. You keep circling back. Mm-hmm. Until something emerges.
The key here is to find the truth of it. You might need to work through in a free write what that truth might look like, and then through the polishing of it just a little bit, you would really zero in on that truth and play with it a little bit.
So what we're going to try, and part of this is just to see what he's getting at and this actually works. We have two different style writers, you and me. And so this is my scientist cap coming on. Let's generate a list, probably about a full page of words. Then pick one of the words and write about 3 pages of prose poetry essay.
3 pages?
Well, like, I mean, people do daily pages where they're 3 pages of something, right?
Well, that's like a free write, a prose poem. In my head, it was like a page, maybe less.
But... No, but he says here, somewhere along the middle of the page or perhaps on the second page, the prose poem would turn into a story.
Oh, you're right.
So the idea is if it clicks on you on the halfway through part of the first page, then you just jump to the story and write the story. If it's not coming in, just keep going for up to 3 pages and we can decide if it did work out.
Yeah.
And then the final bit would be not necessarily to write a story, although maybe we'll be inspired to write a story, but to at least figure out what the story is or what you'd be drawn to write next.
Right. Does this activity get our brain to come up with a story?
Right. Let's go back to this idea of the crowd where his memory was of this accident and all the details. It took place next to an old factory and a cemetery. I think his story involved all the dead people coming out of the cemetery to observe. So that's the point that it leaves his own memory and becomes a story.
Yeah.
The approach is generate a list, and that's all subconscious, just words that come to mind. Go through that list and pick something that has meaning to you that you realize, oh, this is what this means. And then start writing freeform, prose poetry essay, on what it means until suddenly from this experience pops a new story. So it's not necessarily an account of this time I saw the accident and what I was feeling. It jumps into the realm of fiction.
Okay, so that's the key, right? It has to be fiction.
Yeah.
So we're writing a story.
Right.
Okay.
So no memoir.
Okay.
So I think we have our exercise. We are going to go our separate ways now and do some work on that. And we will be discussing how it went in the second half of the podcast.
Excellent.
And now we come to the exercise part of our podcast. If you're new to Words to Write By, you probably haven't heard this part of our podcast. It's the point where we take the exercises in the book and we actually do them.
It's pretty fun.
It is fun. It's good having a partner to do them with because often our first approach to exercise is not the correct one. And we need to step back and try it again. Or if we don't want to try it again because it wasn't very pleasant, at least figure out what we went wrong on and what we would do differently the next time.
Right. And one of the reasons we do these podcasts and we do the exercises is because it holds us accountable. Because how many times have you bought a craft book and you go to the back and you go, I could do that activity. And somehow in your brain, it tells you that, oh, then I guess I did do the activity, but it ain't the same thing. We do the activities to hold us accountable. What's awesome is we can hold you accountable too. If you go to Patreon, you can post your activity and we will critique it like we critique each other's activities on the episode.
And this activity was really cool and fun and not very painful compared to some of the earlier ones that we did. We're going to do Renee's exercise in this podcast. And then on Patreon, we'll have a bonus podcast, which will describe how I did the exercise. And that's for our Abby tier listeners. And that's only $2 a month extra just to hear another version of these exercises that we do.
And you get my awesome show notes.
So how was the list making, reaching into your subconscious and pulling out these words?
Well, I think following this prompt made me realize the kind of person I am. I overthink everything. And so I got really hung up on this has to come from my subconscious. And so I'm sitting there trying to write this list. And I feel like none of it was coming from my subconscious. I knew exactly where everything was coming from. Every noun, I was like, yep, I had a memory of that. Yep, I know where that's coming from. And I just thought, I'll just keep going. Trust the process. And eventually I will hit some subconscious thing. I feel like I failed in that sense. I knew exactly where every single noun came from. The subconscious part of the activity didn't come until later when I started doing that prose poem essay that he talks about.
As a memoirist, you have been examining all these aspects of your life and you have identified a whole bunch of objects and things that had meaning to you. So they're all sitting right there getting in the way of a deeper subconscious.
That's exactly what happened. I wanted to meditate on it, but I'm not good at meditating anyway. I was on a vacation in Tahoe. people say, I went to Tahoe, and then like the skiing, I've actually never skied or snowboarded, and I still have not skied and snowboarded, but I did sit in a cabin a lot and I drank a lot of mimosas. And my husband wouldn't really leave me alone.
You were on vacation together. What was he thinking?
And I even said, Max, I need to go do this activity. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to sit here. And he's like, okay, I'll leave you alone. And then he starts playing on Reddit and like videos are playing. I'm like, hey. And then I finish it up and then our friends come back and I'm like, there is no way.
So in the end, the list was all words that you kind of knew.
Yeah, they all had meaning. But I did do well. So this wasn't really part of the activity, but before Bradbury talks about his listing activity, he does preface it by saying, as a writer, you should know your loves and your hates. Like, you got to really know yourself. And so just to make sure that I was trying to dig into my subconscious, I actually wrote down a list of loves and hates, which came into play later. And that was actually really helpful. So if you have a hard time writing this list, listener, try writing down your lists of loves and hates first, or maybe during the list if you're having a hard time with it, because that was helpful for me.
But your list of loves and hates was not included in your 87 words you came up with, correct?
No, it was not.
So then in order to at least introduce some amount of randomness to it, we each chose three numbers for the other person so they could count on their list and have to have three options to write from. And Renee, I gave you three numbers. What were the three words that you had to work with?
So the numbers you gave me came up with these words: the scarf, the sawdust, the gutter. I think this was the best part of the activity because this is where it turned into a subconscious thing. I could hardly remember where they came from, but for some reason, once they've been pulled out of the list, they became more random.
So at the time you were thinking of them, they didn't feel like it was random. But then when you came back and looked at them, it was like, what was I thinking?
Yeah. And eventually I figured out where they came from, but because they weren't part of that list, it gave me freedom to disassociate the memory from, you know, where the noun came from.
Did you start writing right away then when you had the list or?
No, friends came over, drinks were drunk, games were played, things happened. And then the next day I said, Max, you have to leave me alone. I'm going to focus on this activity. And I did for about 20 minutes. And then he came and bugged me again. It was like, what is going on? And I'm having flashbacks of a room in one zone for Virginia Woolf. I'm like, okay, go away. So I made him go away. And I really dug into it. The problem here was that word prose poem. That was a trigger word for me because that is the poetry I write. Does this have to sound like a prose poem? My process for poetry is very different. And I got hung up on the technicalities of that. Eventually, I just told myself, don't think of it as a prose poem essay. Think of it as focused free write. And that kind of set me free.
Do you want to read some of what you wrote?
Yeah. So remember, listener, this is a free write with a little bit of poetic stuff thrown in. Yours might sound totally different, so don't get hung up on what I wrote. So here's just a sample. And it turned out to be like 2 pages, single spaced. So I'm not going to read that whole thing. So I ended up choosing the gutter. When I think of the gutter, I was thinking specifically of Watchmen. And we've talked about that comic book exhaustively on this podcast already. But if you've seen or read the Watchmen, you'll know the significance of the gutter. More importantly, because Watchmen is commentary on comics in general, when I wrote the gutter, I was thinking of this concept in writing and in comics where between two panels, there's this gap and your brain has to fill in the blank of the gap. I like that metaphor. I heard somebody talk about that in terms of writing, where you don't have to write every single thing that happens. The reader will fill in the subconscious between the two ideas. And I thought, oh, that's what I'm going to write about. So keep in mind when I mentioned the gap, that's what I'm talking about. So I wrote gutter, something discarded. What's down there? Left unsaid. Putting two and two together. The gap. Lost between places. Limbo. But what's in there? Gaps and leaps in time, gaps in understanding, understanding despite knowing, deduction, leaps of faith. There must be something in limbo. So what's the purpose? Only when you know all, that's when you leave, as all the dead do. So, you know, there's a little bit.
When you were writing this, you had the idea from the physical gutter in comics. At what point when you're writing this down, did a story occur to you?
Bradbury in the chapter talks about how it took him about a page and a half, 2 pages, and a character comes out. He says that you should imbue your characters with the loves and hates that you have. To me, it helped connect how a character came about in this by knowing what my loves and hates were. And part of this gap comes from a hate of mine. What I hate is not understanding something, not knowing something, which is where my exhaustive notes come from. I don't like feeling like I'm left out of the bigger understanding of things. And I realized that this gap is both something I love and hate, because it's the gaps and making the connections in things that I read and stories and stuff. That's the pleasure of it. I love that. But then in real life, I hate not knowing. And I'm like, oh, what a neat conundrum. And so I found a character that has the same thing. I wrote, Joey knew the formula. The working world clearly moved toward programming. Although his friend wanted to study comics, Joey wanted an easy life. His mom was unpredictable and bipolar drug addict. He came home to a different mom every day. So he decided he knew how to escape uncertainty and poverty by picking a sure thing in life. During a class in college, a teacher assigned a poem by Edgar Allan Poe. Joey found that he couldn't figure it out and he gets really mad, but his friend Sean tries to help him see the meaning. So Joey and Sean were both artists in public school. But once Joey got a scholarship to go to college to escape his impoverished life, it wasn't contingent in his scholarship to continue to major in art. So he used his art to get into college and then did a switcheroo and became a programmer, majored in programming.
Computer science.
Computer science, yes. But Sean, his friend, decided to stick with art. And so Sean tries to help him see the meaning in this poem, but Joey gets mad. And he says he shouldn't have to learn the world from people who drink themselves to death anyway. Art is a poverty sentence. So if you end up that way, it's your fault. If you end up poor, you only have yourself to blame. And that was the last conversation Sean and Joey had. Joey goes off into the world. He becomes a computer programmer, works for Google or whatever. He becomes kind of obsessed with figuring out, did he make the right choice? He hires a private investigator to follow Sean around to give him updates on his life.
He works at Google and yet he hires a private investigator.
Oh, I didn't think about
that. Never mind. Sorry.
Maybe he just stalks him. Yeah. He just stalks him on Facebook or wherever and tries to get little details out of his life. Oh, look, Sean doesn't make a lot of money. Oh, look where he lives in his apartment. He keeps looking at his past friend's life to like give himself boosts. Like, oh, I made the right choice. Screw Sean. Ha ha. Like that would have been me. But better now. But then what's interesting that came out of this activity was this idea of limbo. And I decided the River Styx is a kind of limbo. And I thought of the boatsman and I'm like, God, the boatsman, that's gotta be life in limbo. You're just going back and forth. And I decided, oh my God, when Joey dies, he decides to become the boatsman because he doesn't wanna know. He doesn't want to take any risks like that. And one day, as Joey's going back and forth on the river, moving the souls of the dead, Sean gets on the boat. And Joey and Sean have a conversation as Joey takes him across the River Styx. Or maybe Sean learns who it is by the end. I don't know. I got essentially to a premise. I got a character. I got semi-plot or backstory of a character. And then I got the premise of a story.
Is this, like, I know you haven't done too much fiction writing, but is the results of this similar to what you usually had when you do fiction writing?
When I've done fiction writing in the past?
Mm-hmm. How does this contrast? The story you came up with here compared to what stuff you've done before, how does it contrast?
My attempts at fiction haven't been very successful, but I actually created a more genuine character than I've ever created. Mm-hmm. Most of the characters I created, like when I was an undergrad and took fiction classes, all of the protagonists were me. I wrote nonfiction in the guise of fiction.
It was Renee having an adventure.
Or it was my past self. Like once in college, I wrote a story about my mom who thought she was psychic. She was really into tarot cards and shit. That was the world I grew up in, listener. She went to psychic fairs. People would pay her for psychic readings. And I was like, this is dumb because I'm like a total skeptic. So I wrote a story about a teenage girl who is a total skeptic who ends up having to go to a psychic fair. And then she gets so mad at her mom that she picks up one of these big glass crystal ball things. And then she just throws it on the ground, you know, because she's a teenager. She needs to get attention or whatever. That never happened, right? But really me, this one was a little different because this one was, I obviously didn't major in computer programming, but I remember those students. As a teacher, sometimes I'll assign a poem or whatever. I don't need to learn how to write. This is crap. I'm just going to be a computer programmer anyway. And I'm like, you would be surprised about how much writing you have to do as a computer programmer. And then they say something like, well, the humanities, those people end up poor anyway. Everybody should just do what's safe. And if you don't make money because you majored in writing or poetry or art, you know, you only have yourself to blame. And it's like, oh God, really? So you just want the world to be a bunch of computer programmers? I had that person in mind, but it wasn't me. But he did imbue him with my fear of uncertainty.
I think part of the exercise was he was taking things that were personal to him, but then removing them for the actual fiction. He wasn't writing stories about his own life as much as he was finding something that was a spark. And because it had a connection to him, it was more meaningful. You're showing the connection. It wasn't just your uncertainty that you imbibed the character with, but your experience with these other people that left an impression on your mind and a mixing of the two of them to come up with something that was fiction. You create a story that wasn't reliant on someone knowing you or wanting to know a particular story that happened in your life. They would never know what your personal background was, but they would be touched by those connections that story had to you indirectly. I think that's one of the strengths of Bradbury's pieces. They're meaningful stories. They're not just adventure science fiction stories. They have a deeper meaning, but they're not an obvious deeper meaning.
He focuses mostly on social science fiction, what they call social science fiction. And I actually teach a class on social science fiction. I love, one of my loves in the world. Essentially, social science fiction focuses on like removing something out of context in order to have a conversation about it.
But I think this is different. Definitely the stories stray into that area. But there's a human connection to the stories. It doesn't matter the fantastical stuff that's going on, like his electric grandmother story, which was a movie I saw in a class. And I didn't even know it was Bradbury until years later. And like, wait, it's going, yep, that's totally the kind of story that he would tell. The connection of a robot in the household and the family members connection. And it played perfectly well as a regular story to show kids because it tapped into ideas that they couldn't understand.
Right. These people felt very real. All of his stories, people feel real. Mm-hmm. I kept thinking of him as I was doing this activity, and I got the sense that by doing this activity, I now have an opportunity to investigate where this love and hate of uncertainty comes from, making those connections in that gap. I can investigate it through this character. And so by doing that, it's going to be more genuine because it's genuinely happening in me. I myself am investigating this. Like, why does this thing bother me and put me in this weird place? Why do I push against it in other ways? And how is he doing that? This will make Joey more real.
Those ideas you're working with will fit very well for the final conversation between Joey and his friend on that boat, which the whole story hinges on. And it's something I want to talk about when we do the bonus podcast, some aspects of the way these stories come about and feel. But we'll talk about that in our bonus podcast. I have one last question for you before we wrap up, which is, do you think you're going to write this story?
I might. I mean, I don't really write a lot of fiction, but I really liked this premise. I don't know where this came from. I would never have just thought of this. I want to read this story. I want to find a story where it's the backstory of the boatsman on the River Styx. The only way I'm going to get to read that story is if I write it. I might be so curious that I might have to write it.
Well, I think the one good thing also with the Bradbury method appears that you write the stories really fast. If you decide to write the story, you should not spend the next 3 weeks working on it. You should pick one night and just write as much as you can.
One night?
I found a podcast that was talking about doing the Ray Bradbury challenge. The idea was you write a short story a week for a year on the premise that you can't write 52 bad short stories. At least one of them has to be good at that point. It would be really interesting to see how far you could push this, how quickly. Not something you're going to string along with for weeks and feel guilty about not doing, but just like to hit it hard and see what you can come out with. And then maybe put it away for a while and take a look at it later.
That's a good idea. Can wine be involved or do I have to be totally sober?
No, wine can be involved, but you'll have to kick Max out of the room.
Yeah.
So this is what Renee got out of it. I got something different, although it has certain similarities, and we will be discussing that on our bonus podcast that our Patreon members can go and see. We've already talked about Patreon. So let's just wrap up this episode by thanking everybody who might have come along to hear more about Bradbury's work process.
Yeah, this was really valuable, and I can't wait to read your post. Your nouns will be really cool to see.
Yeah, the noun lists are great. I think we should publish our noun lists in their full. This is just so we have them up somewhere because they are a fun setup. And if you were to see a noun that would spark a story, that would be fine. We wouldn't mind you stealing one of our nouns for a story.
Oh, yeah, you could totally steal a noun, but it's good to come up with your own nouns. And I'll throw my prose poem essay, even though it's kind of rando, on there, just so you could see how it came out, because you might be stuck on that too. Like, what the heck is he talking about?
We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast. If you have, then we'd love you to check out our Patreon site. But even more, if you could rate or review this podcast on the podcast service that you listen to, especially Apple Podcasts, that'd be great. That will increase us on our rating and get a better chance for other people to find this podcast.
And if you have a writer friend, send our podcast to them.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, thanks for listening. Have a great week.
Till next time.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smiga Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
I don't know. I guess maybe I just kind of projected you into the character. She had a lot of the same qualities. She left the house and then she goes to Costco and...